Hello, and welcome to the Comic Book Page Back Issue Spotlight. My name is John Mayo, and I'll be your host.
And I'm Bob Breitall. In this episode, we'll be discussing a wide variety of back issues that John and I have recently acquired or read, as well as a spotlight on a classic comic storyline.
So, what new back issues did you buy this time, Bob?
Well, this time I'm going to focus on DC stuff, and I have got a hold of Showcase number 23, which is the second appearance of the Silver Age Green Lantern, Hal Jordan, as well as Green Lantern number 71, 73, 77, and 78. And it was actually this set of issues that prompted me suggesting we do the Hard Traveling Heroes Green Lantern stuff, because I got two of the issues out of the story arc we're going to be reviewing today. I only need number 76 to complete that arc and complete my Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill run on Green Lantern, which is a kind of a classic run. I also got about 10 copies of Adventure Comics with Supergirl in them, four more to go on the Supergirl run in Adventure. I got five issues of The Atom, that's the Silver Age, three issues to go there. I got Hawkman number 7, which completed my Hawkman run.
Oh, cool. Congratulations.
And I got six issues of House of Mystery with Robbie Reed dialing H for Hero, and that completed my Dial H for Hero run of House of Mystery. I got eight issues of Metal Men, four issues of Superboy, and a couple issues of Teen Titans. I only need nine more issues of Teen Titans, and strangely, I have all the early issues. I need issues 23 through 31 of the Silver Age Teen Titans, and I don't know why I don't have that run in the middle there, but I have all the early issues, I have all the later issues, and I'm missing nine issues right in the middle on that. But that pretty much does it for my DC back issue activity lately.
If I think about it all, when I'm at one of the local stores that's got a huge back issue selection, I'll take a look at the Titan stuff, see what they got, and let you know.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Now, that House of Mystery run with the Robbie Reed Dial H, that's one that I really want to get, but I am just too cheap to spend that kind of money, because those go for a couple of bucks. I mean,
they were not that expensive. I'll talk about it. Like, basically, again, I buy down in the very good and fine grades, and I paid under $10 an issue for these from mycomicshop.com, by the way, in very good.
Yeah, I guess part of it is there's enough of the issues that I need, and I tend to get kind of focused, and it's like, okay, you know, get as many as I can at once, and it sort of adds up at that price range.
Yeah,
I
mean, that's true.
And it, again, not bad prices, but when you start saying, gosh, I want, you know, 15 of these or whatever.
Right. Yeah, you get start talking about some serious cash.
Yeah, but that's definitely a run that I'm personally interested in. Why don't we talk a little about just kind of shopping online for comics? You were mentioning that some people were kind of asking what we thought on that.
Right. There were some comments out on the forum about tips and tricks on back issue shopping. So I thought we could focus each episode for a few episodes on different venues. We'll start with online stores this episode and move into eBay, local shops, conventions, and future episodes of Back Issue Spotlight. So my first one that I want to talk about in online stores is mycomicshop.com. It's run by Lone Star Comics. I discovered these guys maybe about 6-8 months ago from somebody on the forum pointing me in their direction. And they are a very good source for back issues. They have great sale prices. I would definitely recommend that you sign up for their mailing list, because there are a variety of books each week that have an extra 10% off. Like, for instance, this week, I think they had an extra 10% off on DC books starting from letters A through L, and then war books and, you know, a couple other categories. But if you wait for any, you know, 4 to 6 week period, pretty much any kind of category of books that you want to get are going to show up in that sale. So that's definitely worth doing. One thing I like about them also is they have free shipping if you spend $50 or more. I'm huge on the free shipping for buying comics online. And one thing with mycomicshop.com is there are really great prices to be had, but then sometimes not so much. So I always will shop with my price guide in my hand. And the last batch of books that I got from them, I got pretty much everything in there for 50% or less of guide price. But there were other books I looked at that were double or triple guide price. You know, so they're not going with strict Overstreet pricing on their things. But I will say that as far as grading goes, they are very good sticklers for grading. I have not been disappointed with their grading, and I'm buying down in the very good and fine grades, and they do a really good job. They use Overstreet guidelines for grading, and they're excellent and accurate on their grading. They also do an excellent job of packaging things for shipment, almost overpacking things sometimes. I mean, it's like really securely packed. I've never had something damaged in shipment from these guys.
Yeah, I've made a number of orders from them in the past couple of months, and overall I agree entirely. These guys are great to deal with. They've got some excellent prices. Their selection is tremendous. Their website is just very user-friendly, easy to find things. The only two kind of, I guess, caveats, I've got a mailbox at a local UPS store for where I get my comics from DCBS, so I wanted to have the orders I went and got from my comic shop going there. Because that's a different mailing address than my billing address, there were some gymnastics I had to go through to deal with that. And basically what it came down to was on the first order, they won't do that. Once they've shipped you an order, they'll ship it anywhere you want, which I thought was just kind of insane, but that's how they want to do it, that's fine. So I wound up having the first issue shipped to my house versus where I wanted it. Fortunately, that was between the hurricanes we were having and thunderstorms, so no damage was done, but made me a little antsy. But that's just one. Go in knowing that if you want to have it shipped to a different place than your billing address, you may have to forego that on your first order or just deal with that. The other kind of caveat I have is on the packing. I agree with you entirely. They do an excellent job packing, and that is my complaint. Because a few of the orders I've placed, I'm getting like 100 books. They ship their books unbagged and unboarded, depending on the nature of the book. Older books are going to be bagged and boarded. A lot of the stuff I'm getting is kind of either 80s or more recent stuff, so it's not. What they do is they sandwich it between two pieces of cardboard, put that in a plastic bag, and then seal that with tape. And then they do that in bundles, and then they tape the bundles together. So it's rock solid. But man, it takes forever to get the stuff out of there. And there's enough tape going around that kind of makes me a little antsy with the covers and stuff just for potential damage unpacking it. I haven't had any, but it's...
In general, the tape is always on top of a plastic bag, so I haven't had an issue with that.
No, it always is, but I'm just thinking once I get the comics out of the bag, there's enough tape lying around if I'm not careful. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I usually put it right in the trash can.
But, I mean, nothing's come damage. They do a great job packing. They check the grade before they ship it. I haven't had any incorrect items, and I've been very pleased with that. This is the store I go to first when I'm looking for back issues.
Yeah, me too. And I will say I had one issue one time that I had an issue with, and I got a hold of them, and they were completely good about, you know, go ahead and return it. They credited me back for the book, and they credited me back for my return shipping as well.
Cool.
So they are meticulous in that, and they're a very good place to go. They're my number one source online for buying back issues. Now, the next one we can talk about is almost, you know, could be thought of as the granddaddy of online stores, and that's Mile High Comics. So, John, do you want to give some initial thoughts here?
Yeah, I'll take that one. I've placed a number of orders with Mile High. They've got a very good selection of back issues. Their prices, I don't think, are necessarily as competitive as my comic shop, and really they vary. The way they price stuff is a combination of kind of sort of Overstreet, how much they've got, what specials Chuck Rosansky wants to be running, and they've got this big repricing algorithm they run either every day or however often. So it's one you want to check back and see how the prices are going because they can fluctuate. Overall, the prices feel higher on most items. There have been a couple of times I'll put together shopping lists at both Mile High and My Comics. My Comics usually wins out. But what I usually use Mile High Comics for these days is getting the stuff that I just haven't found elsewhere because they've got such a good selection that, you know, the odds of them having it are fairly high. I think that their website is not as polished as I think it should be. It's one that was one of the earlier online comic stores, I believe, and the website reflects that. They seriously need to update this. If you sign up for their mailing list, you get the weekly emails of what the discount code is. I highly recommend that if you're going to be placing orders, because, I mean, you should pay as little as possible, and the discount codes help on that.
Yeah, I used to shop with these guys a lot, and I would never buy when they weren't running a sale, because they run sales so frequently that you're just getting ripped off if you don't buy during the sales. The other thing I'll add on pricing is that any issue that's even remotely a key issue or a rare issue is going to have a mile high price. They are insanely expensive on some things, you know, even more so than mycomicshop.com, you know, where I said kind of have a price guide in your hand. You absolutely need to have a price guide in your hand at Mile High, because while they have the best selection, and if you really need an issue, you can probably find it there. But, you know, some things that they have are, you know, 5-10 times overstreet on these things, especially in the higher grades. You know, again, I collect in the lower grades on the old stuff. I would frequently get stuff below guide and, you know, do very well with Mile High in that respect. However, caveat, anything key, anything older in high condition is going to have a really pretty high price. But people are buying from them because they do very well for themselves.
I've got an order I placed with them that I think we talked about either on the first back issue spotlight or one of the weekly comic spotlight, where they shipped me the wrong issue of one of the Superman family issues I wanted. I have since sent that back. They should have gotten that, I believe, certainly by now. And I'm still waiting for that to kind of get resolved. So we'll see how well they handle that.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll do fine, but
my thing with them is, and I, after I had a huge blowout with them over grading, I stopped using them. But recently I've put an order with them just because there were certain things that I wanted to get that were more recent. They were all near mint condition. But, you know, they're like indie things, you know, like they had an issue of the one issue of Brit that I wanted to get. They had that in stock. They had some copies of this Bigfoot comic from IDW, Forever Amber from Image, and just like wacky, you know, Battle Pope. They had some issues of Battle Pope for not bad prices. If there's an indie book or a recent book that you're looking for, chances are they'll have it. And again, I bought in near mint condition on these, so that brings up my main problem with Mile High is that they have their own grading standards, and it's on their website. And if you're going to buy for Mile High Comics, I urge you to click on the link at Mile High and examine their grading standards, because they're Chuck Rosansky standards. And especially in the lower grades, I bought from them for years and I didn't have a problem until the one time I got a very good comic that had a huge tear in the cover. And when I sent back to their customer service and said, hey, you know, there's a huge tear in the cover of my comic book. And they're like, yeah, so what? You know, I'm like, well, it's very good. You know, it shouldn't have a big tear on the cover, about an inch and a half long. And they go, oh, read our grading standards. That's allowable and very good, according to us. And it's like, that's when I stopped buying back issues from Mile High that were in the lower grade. So I switched over. It's much to the benefit of mycomicshop.com, because I've probably spent $1,000 at mycomicshop.com since Mile High drove me away. But beware of their grading in lower conditions, because they have looser standards than you might be used to if you follow Overstreet and other places like that.
Well, and that's just good advice in general. If you're going from an online store, make sure that you've read their policies on how they grade, on how they ship, on all those things, and that you're comfortable with that.
Right.
You know, you want as few surprises as possible. And part of that is you got to do your research.
Right.
Each site's going to have potential different rules for how they handle things.
You know, the third site that I wanted to, the only other online site that I've regularly bought back issues from is called Newkadia.com, Newkadia. Now, something that's very interesting about this site is that they have the books, they keep track of how many weeks they've had that book in stock. And the longer they've had it in stock, the lower the price goes. So, you know, if they've had something sitting on their site for 2 years, it's maybe 30% off or 40% off or something like that. And they'll give more discount the longer they've had that particular issue sitting in stock, which is kind of interesting. Now, the other interesting thing is they price to Overstreet. They're very meticulous about that. They also use plus and minus grading, which a lot of the other stores don't. So, you know, if they have something and they call it very good plus, it's going to be in between the very good Overstreet price and the fine Overstreet price. So their pricing, you tend to find less blowout deals on things at Newcadia because they are relatively strict about pricing to Overstreet. So unless a book that you're looking for is something that's been sitting on their site for a couple of years, you're probably not going to find something at half Overstreet, which I regularly find at the other online sites. So that's something to be aware of. On the plus side, they have free shipping on all orders. So, I mean, they think they have a minimum order of like $10 or something like that. But, you know, any order that you get, they're going to ship to you for free. So if you just want to pick up a couple of books, go and check them out. They're certainly not going to rip you off. They're very meticulous about pricing to guide. Their grading is pretty good. I have a little bit of issue with some of the plus and minus grading, especially in the lower grades. You know, when you get into that fine a distinction, there's a lot of subjectivity to it. I think just doing very good, fine, very fine, near mint, etc., that leaves some of the other shops with a little more leeway on people having problems with the grading. But since these guys do get pretty granular on their grading, I've had a little bit of issue with them. On the other hand, they're very willing to take things back, exchange. I have sent things back to them. They have not had a problem. I've gotten refunds. So they're very good on that respect. Buyer beware on that kind of stuff. I think we've given you kind of a overview of three of the main shops that are out there online. If other people have other shops that they'd be interested in talking about that you've had a good experience with, certainly shoot an email to us at theguys@comicbookpage.com, because I'd be happy to check out any other sites. Now, I don't know if happy's the right word. My wife won't be happy because I'll spend more money on back issues. But
I would certainly be interested in other sites, because while I've looked around at Newcadia, I don't think I've ever bought anything from them. I do most of my back issue shopping either locally at conventions or on eBay, but on online stores, either from Mile High, but primarily from my comic shop. So if there are other good places that have excellent selection or maybe more interesting search features or something else, or better prices for that matter, I would certainly be very interested in that, because there are a couple of issues, back issues here and there, that I'm still having a hard time finding. And while my comic shop and Mile High do get new things in on a regular basis, you know, if there's another comic shop online that's got it sitting in stock already, I'm all for that. So please, if you've got other places you're shopping online, let us know. Let us know what you think, and we'll happily include that in a future episode of the Back Issue Spotlight.
Yep, that's absolutely true. And next episode, we're going to talk about eBay.
Cool. Shall we go to our feature story of the episode?
Sure. Hard Traveling Heroes. I don't think that's ever named somewhere, but I've heard it called that in a lot of other online or article type of places. It's the story arc from Green Lantern number 76 through 81. That's where Neil Adams came on, did his famous run with Denny O'Neil. And one of the reasons it's called Hard Traveling Heroes is that as part of the storyline, one of the Guardians of the Universe comes to Earth and is made human to some extent, and he drives around the U.S. in a pickup truck with Green Lantern and Green Arrow, and they have a variety of adventures along the way. So what do you think, John?
Well, I read the reprints of these, both when they first came out back in late 1983 and again in preparation for this. And there are two things I really want to point out about these stories, just to kind of set the tone of the conversation. And the first is that these were originally done back in, I believe it was 1969. Is that when these originally were published?
1970.
April
1970 was issue 76, And then issue 81, went in December of 70. So April through December of 1970.
Okay.
Which an April issue of 1970 would have been on the stands around maybe December 69, January 70, somewhere around there.
And a lot of these stories are dealing with social issues of the time. And it's been a few years since then. It was a few years since then, when I read it in 1983. So you've got to take part of the stories in that context of these were very relevant social issues at the time, and racial inequality,
pollution,
authority figures,
overpopulation.
And some of these are still issues today, some not so much. And certainly the tone of the conversations for these issues has evolved over time. And I really enjoyed these issues when I first read them in 1983. I enjoyed them when I reread them last night, just not as much. And, I'm not really sure why. They were good stories, good art. Part of it is they had, Denny O'Neil was the writer, and as was done at the time, there's a bit more, I almost will say, flowery dialogue, a bit more of the narration and the, much like we had with the Kree-Skrull War and Roy Thomas's kind of writing in the Stan Lee style. This wasn't necessarily the Stan Lee style, but had various similarities to it.
Yeah, I would say one thing about that is that some of it was a little heavy-handed.
Yeah, that was the term I was just about to use.
But taking into the context of the time of 1970, right, the audience of comics was at that time firmly considered to be little kids.
Yeah.
So I think that Denny O'Neil was kind of bludgeoning you over the head with some of this stuff because there was perhaps a bit of a concern that if you were too subtle about it, the message would just go over the head of most of the readership. So, he made really darn sure you got the idea that he was trying to bring across.
And like I said, this really worked for me when I read the reprints in 1983. Now, it would not have worked for me at all had I read them originally, because I would not have been old enough to read at the time. But that's just, me being a youngin' and stuff, I guess. But whereas, as a 13, 14-year-old, I needed to have a bit more of a heavy-handed and kind of pointed story, at this point where I'm at now, I have less of a need of that. And also, reading six issues back-to-back-to-back versus, when they originally came out in a monthly basis, there are a couple of things that really picked up, as the repetition, the expository dialogue, the resetting of the scene, as was the writing standard of the time. And I think, to a degree, ought to still be the writing standard today, because I think comics would benefit with some of that. Maybe not to the stereotypical Chris Claremont degree of I am Storm, I am claustrophobic, woe is me, I am Cyclops, woe is me, kind of heavy-handedness. So you've got to read these with the awareness of time socially and artistically in terms of storytelling conventions that they were told in. And if you go with that in mind, these are still very good stories and very kind of pivotal stories in the relationship between Hal Jordan and Oliver Queen. And part of it is just how different the Guardians were back then, how different the DC Universe was back then.
And the Guardians were real jerks. they were real jerks in these stories. Denny O'Neil set them up as the man, the establishment, the atypical, let's just follow the party line and black and white thinking and all that as a counterpoint, to Green Arrow being almost like a total hippie. And then Hal Jordan is our conscience in the story because he's going from really over the top, towing the line to all forms of authority, to over the course of these issues, seeing that there are shades of gray in the world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the Guardians were so much the authority by committee, the unified voice. There, like you said, there is no black and white. There is no dissension in the ranks. And, at this point, Green Arrow was nothing but dissension. And part of it is when you pair up characters like Green Lantern and Green Arrow, it's kind of like doing a Superman-Batman team-up. You got one guy that's so powerful and another guy that's just more or less a normal human with a couple of cool toys, that telling an interesting story can be challenging. And of course, by doing it to where it's all social relevance, moral ambiguity, it takes the power level difference completely out of the equation in many respects. And of course, one of the other ways they handled that was because Hal was kind of on the outs with the Guardians to a degree, they cut down his power level substantially to where the ring was no longer as reliable as it was, as powerful as it was. And I don't know if that was the first time they had done that. It's a little bit of a writing crutch, I think, but kind of well used in this story.
Yeah, I agree. It made it more equitable that Green Lantern couldn't just go in and take him, because realistically, at a fully power level, most of the things that came up in these stories, you know, would have been over in two panels.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's, though, kind of how they start the entire storyline, is Hal trying to take care of something in two or three panels, and Green Arrow saying, no, it's more complicated than that, and looking for the subtleties, looking deeper for the what's really going on.
Right. Now, this first issue here, 76, has arguably one of the most famous three-panel sequences in comics, where the older black man comes up to Green Lantern and says, I've been reading about how you work for the Blueskins and how on a planet someplace you helped out the Orange Skins and you done considerable for the Purple Skins, only there's skins you never bothered with, the Black Skins. I want to know, how come? Answer me that, Mr. Green Lantern. And Green Lantern's only reply is, I can't. And I mean, that really sets the tone for the entire series, because he's seeing that not everything is black and white, and you can't always solve a problem by just going in and slapping down who ostensibly looks like the bad guy. Because in this first issue here, there's some youths on the street, and they're roughing up this guy in a business suit, and you know, he thinks, oh, they're, you know, beating up this older defenseless guy, but it turns out this guy's this slumlord and, you know, all this. But then they start painting it in really broad strokes where, you know, they make him not just a slumlord who owns the building, but I mean, he's like an organized crime figure, and he's, you know, ordering hits on people and all kinds of stuff. So this is where it gets a little heavy handed, because he's not even just like a regular slumlord. They make him very unambiguously a real sleazeball.
It would be fun for them to do a modern kind of, not retelling of this, but twist on this with a newer Green Lantern Green Arrow combination, even maybe, where you do kind of the same storylines, but instead of this guy being this, you know, almost crime boss level slumlord, have him just be a bad landlord. He's not even evil. He's not able to make the fix-ups or whatever, you know, and really kick in the ambiguity.
Right.
You know, that could be either really bad or really fun. But speaking of the villains in this story, you know, for the entire six issues, there's not a supervillain in sight. There's one guy with hypnosis powers in a later issue. But really, aside from that, the only people, I think, in these stories that had superpowers at all were Black Canary, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, and the Guardian.
And Black Canary didn't even have or didn't use the Canary Cry in these stories, so she was just martial art proficient. You know, there was no Canary Cry.
Yeah, considering her and or Green Arrow as superpowered is a stretch. I agree with that. What really got me, though, is how it seemed each issue we got Hal powering up his ring, we get the oath, and I mean, it seems like we can go issues in current Green Lantern stories without hearing the oath, and in a couple of cases, possibly even a few years, maybe, between getting it. And here, not only do we get it almost every issue, if not every issue, we also then get the, and I used to believe this wholeheartedly, now I'm not so sure, you know, moral quandary that he's having. So, a little heavy-handed, but if you didn't read the previous issues, you kind of needed that to get into the story. So, trade-off for the accessibility.
Repetition's a good thing. That's why I know the Green Lantern Oath by heart today. It's because every issue when I was a kid of Green Lantern that I read, he was saying it. So.
Well, and again, you've got to establish things. That's something that... It's funny, because I remember the Blue Beetle series back in the 80s, and it seemed like for the first seven issues, every time he'd get back to his headquarters, he'd do the, and now I must unlock the magnetic latch that keeps my masks, you know, on so nobody can take it off, sort of. It's like, okay, I get it. But if they don't do that, you never know about it, and then when they want to use it as a story point, it's like, well, where the hell did that come from? Overall, like I said, I liked these. It didn't have quite the same level of impact it had when I first read them as a kid, and part of that is I was at a different place then and now.
Yeah, so I was a little older than you. I didn't read these off the rack. I was only 8, but I read these in 1983 in those reprint books, same as you, and I was around 20 then. And even then, I mean, at 20, I wasn't the most worldly 20-year-old. I mean, this had a far different impact on me than it does now, 23 years later, you know, when I'm older, and I can certainly see things in a far different light. But, you know, we kind of tick through the issues, you know. So he fought the slum lord in issue 76. In issue 77, we had kind of a talk. It's kind of a subtle thing against labor unions and the evil of some fat cat businessman exploiting the workers.
Right.
Right. And then in issue 78, we've got this religious cult figure who's kind of hypnotizing the people, which at the time, I think maybe it would have been Moonies or something that was being obliquely referenced. Then we have racism. Then we have pollution. And then we have overpopulation. And each one of these kind of social issues gets handled in turn with them. And they really, you know, hit and they show you how, okay, well, here's the black and white way of looking at it. But then here's all, if you peel back the onion a little bit, here's some of the layers that exist underneath. And here's some of the other things that you should think about. And it's not as simple as it might seem on the face of things.
Well, and that aspect is something I still enjoy, because I always get frustrated when people only see the simplistic aspect of a situation, because I'm firmly in the camp that things are always more complicated than they appear. Part of that is just some of my own issues going through life or whatever. I mean, I've got celiac disease, and that means I've got to carefully consider everything I eat. So when people say, oh, let's just go for barbecue, it's just meat, I'm like, well, geez, what the hell's in the sauce? What the hell's it cooked with? And those kind of things.
What else has been on the grill, right? You know?
Exactly, exactly. It's not just what's in front of me, it's what's surrounding the issue. I've got to dig deeper. So having the comics where they're doing that, I like. You know, I wish that would happen a bit more in modern comics. I would have liked to have seen somewhere during Civil War, somebody really digging into the specifics and the subtleties of the Superhero Registration Act, of, you know, the implications, and not just you register or you don't. I feel that a lot of things get very simplified in some comics today and just in general.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, that was one of the things that really did work for me on this.
Let's talk a little bit about the art, because I think Neil Adams is praised and rightly as a revolutionary influence. I mean, he brought a certain amount of realism to art that was not prevalent at the time. It's much more prevalent today. Looking at just the art, this does not seem as dated as, you know, looking at the writing, because I think he was certainly ahead of his time on the art chores. You have things like very interesting panel layouts. It's not just the standard grid. He's got some interesting shaped panel layouts sometimes. He's breaking the panels. You know, he's got things reaching out and across panel borders. He's got the panel design becoming almost a story element in certain places. And there's just a lot of revolutionary, you know, for 1970, this was fabulously revolutionary stuff. And it laid the groundwork, I think, for a lot of what has been now accepted as what good comic art should entail.
Having grown up on the comics really of the 80s, where this was such an established convention and commonplace thing, I didn't really notice that while reading this. But certainly looking at it, it's like, yeah, I see exactly what you're talking about. I agree entirely and can see how this kind of influenced various artists going forward, and how we've kind of reverted to a more standard grid style and more simplistic layouts in a lot of comics these days. And, I mean, even on, like, just the page before that three-panel thing with the black eyes, you know, kind of calling out Hal Jordan of, why don't you help us? there's a on the previous page a panel of a close-up of Green Arrow that kind of pops off the page and overlaps on the previous panel and the panel below it. And, I mean, you just don't see stuff like that these days, and certainly didn't see it before, to a degree, Neil Adams was doing it.
Exactly. And even on the panel with the black guy giving Green Lantern the lecture, look at his head. He's popping out of that page, and he's overlapping the panel to the right. And it draws your eye to that, and it just makes that panel pop.
Well, and there's an explicit use of no backgrounds for those three panels.
Right.
Because nothing else is important. We don't even need to see the floor. All we need to see is these two guys talking. There's a certain, I almost want to say Will Eisner-esque aspect to parts of this.
I think there's, you know, that's a good point because there's a certain simplicity to it, but it's got a lot of impact. And that's the same thing with Eisner. Eisner wasn't about over-rendering things. He wasn't about the ridiculous amounts of scratchy detail, but he was about impact. And drawing your eyes to the element on the page that he wanted to make pop and that had the most storytelling impact, and also incorporating design elements into the panels that would enhance the storytelling experience. And Neil Adams does a good job of capturing that in this Green Lantern, Green Arrow run.
Well, he does an excellent job, and there's a subtlety to it that is almost deceptively simple. There's the page where in the first issue, or maybe the second, I've got the reprint, so I can't really tell. He's been called to the Guardians. They've kind of yelled at him, and he's like, okay, I'm sorry, and he's walking out. When he's walking out of their chamber room, he's literally walking out of that panel. It's like he's sitting in front of it and kind of walking into that background panel, which was the first panel sort of thing. And it's...
Yeah.
By having him out of that panel, that says how he's literally kind of on the outs with the Guardians just on so many levels.
Right. That's on page 10 of issue 76. And, you know, it eluded me until I kind of noticed it in the second or so issue that I was reading that he was breaking the panels a lot. And then I went back and I started looking at the story and I saw that he was doing it a tremendous amount. And he was always doing it, it seemed, for a reason, to draw a focus or draw an emphasis. And it was very purposeful.
The only time that it ever kind of interfered with how I read the page was just before the epilogue in that first issue where you've got the guy in the mousetrap. There was something about the way it broke the panel borders that kind of obscured things on me.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it never interferes with the storyline. It never causes confusion as to, well, what should I be reading next? And it's something that you don't notice until you notice, and then you almost can't not notice, if you know what I mean.
And I flip back a few pages from that mousetrap page to page 15 with the arrow and the barrel of the gun.
Yeah, that one was just beautiful, and that was just so nicely done.
And even you go back another couple of pages to page 13 and you look at how he did those three panels there with the kind of the interesting angle for the bottom one where it's not just straight across.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just that kind of thing that I like. Or even the inset panels on the page you mentioned where Green Lantern's walking away from the Guardians.
Mm-hmm.
You have that kind of background that goes across the whole page and then you've got four inset panels into that. You know, that wasn't something that you were seeing a lot of back then.
No, but then you hit a period kind of in the 80s where you started to see some of this because you had the generation of artists that really grew up on this and was heavily influenced by it. But I think we've kind of almost moved out of that era and back towards a more, let's just do a simple grid layout. You still have, certainly there's some great artists out there today that are doing some really innovative storytelling things, and I'm not trying to say that it's not happening. But I read far too many comics where, and there's nothing wrong with a simple, you know, 9-panel grid or variations on the standard grid layout. It can be used well and effectively. But I'm not seeing as much of the kind of groundbreaking panel layouts and almost meta storytelling outside of the individual panels these days that we certainly see just in this one storyline.
You're right.
And I'm kind of curious as to why that is kind of that pendulum sort of swung back and what happened there.
So I think in kind of summary of this storyline, if you're interested in comics art at all, you have got to get a hold of and read this storyline. You know, just for the revolutionary, to me, art techniques that Neil Adams pioneering, and it's just, you know, some beautiful stuff to look at. And then the social relevance, I mean, this really pioneered kind of that social relevancy trend in comics. I mean, while it is dated and you have to look at it with through a lens of the time that it was written in and the audience that it was written for, it certainly, I would consider it to be a historical set of stories to give a read to. And it's relatively easy on those 1983 reprints, John, that you were reading. Those are available at a relatively cheap price.
Yeah.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
How much are those reprints going for on mycomicshop.com, for instance?
Yeah, over on mycomicshop, they are going for, let's see, a near mint, $3.20, $2.40. They've got one only in fun at $2, one at near mint at $2.40, so well under $3.50. I mean, almost what they cost cover price back in the day, which was $2.
And each of those reprints two issues of Green Lantern, Green Arrow.
And really, the ones we were talking about were in the first three issues of the reprint series, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, from 1983. So the total cost is $9.
Yeah, you can't beat that. And it's just, the reprints are not that expensive. They should not be that difficult to get a hold of. Definitely worth giving a read.
Yeah, certainly if you like Neil Adams' art, if you like the social relevance in comics, if you like the Hal Jordan Green Lantern and the Ollie Queen Green Arrow, I highly recommend these. It's just fun stuff. Now, again, a little heavy-handed at times. You've got to keep in mind the era that these comics were written in and kind of the target audience for them. And I say that not as you've got to make allowances, you've got to make excuses, but you've got to just accept that these were not written today for today's audience. And, you know, you got to take them for what they are. If you do that, I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you're looking at, for them to stack up for the action and cosmic excitement that we're getting in, like, the Sinestro Corps War currently at DC with those stories, this is a totally different type of story. So just go in with the right expectations, and I think you'll be happy.
Let me do a quick look here at what Mile High has got them for. Okay, so Mile High Comics has got them for, in near mint, $3.50 for issue 1, $2.80 for issue 2, and $2.80 for issue 3. So again, that's about $9 for all three of those issues, and that is not that bad.
It's not enough to get you the free shipping on either place, but certainly, you know, we're talking $8-$9, yeah.
Buy a couple other things, you know? It's like,
if you can't find other things on these sites, we're not doing our job, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's so much good comics out there. And this reprint series went on for a total of 7 issues, and the other ones include, I believe, when Speedy was doing the drug storyline with
yes.
Speedy, and just some other great stuff.
Yeah, so Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill did the Green Lantern series up through issue 89, and those were all those stories. And then there were three 8-page backup stories in Flash 217, 218, and 219 that also included Green Lantern and Green Arrow by Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams. Those issues are reprinted in number 7 of this reprint series here. There was also a large hardcover reprint that came out a few years back called the Green Lantern Green Arrow Collection that includes all the Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams stuff in one large, nice, if you tend toward the more super deluxe collecting mentality, that is also something you should be able to find somewhere.
Was that one collection or two?
It was one volume. Got it in my hand right now. That's what I didn't dig out my back issues. I read it out of the hardcover. This hardcover came out in 2000, and it's slipcased.
This is probably also available in trades then.
Yep.
It's certainly available in a couple of formats. Definitely worth checking out. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.